Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Decouple Podcast, where we explore the science and technologies that can decouple human well-being from its ecological impacts, and the politics that can make decoupling possible. Welcome back to the Decouple Podcast. I'm here today with Ariel Deranger,
However you want to pronounce his colonial name, I don't really care.
Okay, perfect.
Destroy it, wreck it.
All right, cool. Ariel's a member of the Athabascan Chippewyan Nation and the executive director of the Indigenous Climate Action.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to start off by introducing yourself, telling us the other name you have?
And
Get maybe like 30, 40 seconds just to give us a little self-introduction.
So my full name is Ariel Tsekwi Deranger. Our family's traditional last name is Deskelne, which means river keeper, which is much better than Deranger, which means to disturb. But, you know, I mean, you could go with either or. But my name, Ariel Tsekwi, means Thunder Woman.
Okay.
So that's
and
my
maybe
name.
You're a bit of a shit disturber, the Deranger.
Exactly. I'm like, it's not so bad. River keeper, shit disturber. It works
right.
For me.
Okay. Okay. So we're here obviously at COP26 in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. This is not your first rodeo.
No, it's not.
I don't want to spend too much time on sort of a compare and contrast, but I mean, are you cynical? Are you optimistic? I imagine it's nice to connect with Indigenous people from all over the world. What's your big sort of takeaway or gestalt about about this COP experience?
I don't have a lot of faith in the mechanisms inside the COP. But what I am hopeful about is the fact that the COP itself and the international community is starting to really recognize the rights of Indigenous communities and the knowledge that we hold as critical to building real climate solutions that we need in order to combat and correct course for this climate crisis that we're all in. The problem is they're looking for ways to co-opt it and own it, as opposed to actually decolonizing these systems to allow us to come in. We're not looking to indigenize the structures. We're looking to actually decolonize and create room for our structures, our systems, and our knowledge systems. But my worry is that they're just trying to input it into a colonial structure that has never served our communities. So not super hopeful. Plus, the negotiations are tending to sound more like a trade negotiation as opposed to a climate negotiation.
Yeah, for sure, with the carbon trading
and
that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So what are some of those like Indigenous traditional knowledge type solutions to climate change that you're talking about?
That's a really good question. People ask that a lot, and I think it's a lot less direct, you know, within colonial capitalist green solutions that are often sort of at the front of the climate solutions, like, you know, renewable energy, electric cars, like recycle, all of those things. They're very like direct and tangible. You can calculate the emissions very quickly or easily. But the problem is we reduce the climate crisis to a system where we are calculating carbon in the atmosphere as opposed to solutions that are rooted in relationships. And Indigenous solutions are guided by our relationships, not only with each other, but across species and with the natural world itself. And so those solutions look like language, culture, traditional food systems, activities that further connect us to the land. And how that actually amounts to a climate solution is that there have been numerous studies that have shown that when a language is intact, that the community and the culture is intact, the community is more likely to take care of and steward the land better. That results in increased biodiversity, which results in a better livelihood and life for women and children in the entire community at whole, supporting localized economies and a healthy, happy lifestyle. That has led to the fact that Indigenous peoples represent 80% of the biodiversity that is safeguarded on this planet. This means the boreal forest, the Amazon rainforest, and many other key ecosystems that are critical for climate stabilization have been protected and safeguarded by Indigenous peoples. Those types of solutions aren't included because it's hard to calculate and evaluate them into a capitalist system, which is why a trade negotiation doesn't fit those solutions that cannot be bought and sold.
I mean, it sounds very relational, both with the natural world, but also with each other, with, yes. with human beings. And it's interesting how, I mean, in a lot of environmentalism, there's not really much of a focus on the kind mm-hmm. of human well-being part. So it's interesting to kind of hear a different perspective yeah. in that regard.
Yeah. You wanted me to speak on that a little
Absolutely.
Bit?
Yeah.
I think like that's really important. So like sometimes people are like, oh, when did you become an environmental activist? And I'm like, well, environmentalism was like a dirty word growing up because right. the environmental movement was responsible for the, you know, for our communities, like the death of the fur trade, which was a key right. economy for our right. community. And also that environmentalism was largely led by middle-class white folks mm. that saw the environment as something to protect as an externality.
Right.
Whereas, like, the way, even my nation, our name, Dene or Dene Sulene, means people of the land.
Right.
Our traditional name that our nation is in the process of reclaiming is Kaitale Dene Soklene, which means people of the willow, people of the land. And it's a direct reference to the Athabasca Delta. So the willows grow along the shorelines. Mm-hmm. People of the willow is that reference. And so we are, like, who we are and our identities are indiscernible from the places in which we come from. Mm-hmm. So you destroy the land, you destroy the people.
Right.
And that relationality is a fine balance of reciprocity and deep relationship with those places.
Mm-hmm.
That relationship is fundamentally on the other side of the spectrum of a capitalist system that looks at nature as something to be taken and bought, torn apart and right. bought and sold. What is it worth? How do I make money off of it? As opposed to how do I live in relationship with it?
Or like preserved with no people on it, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There's a big kind of anti-humanism I see in the environmental
exactly.
movement.
Exactly. Yeah. There's sure. the modern or the early iterations of conservation resulted in the forced removal of indigenous right. peoples
from
Yellowstone yeah. National Park in the 1800s. Like that is where it started, and those like they even say the modern or the forefathers of environmentalism are like Thoreau and right. What's his name, the president
Roosevelt.
Yeah, yeah. And the reality is like no, they weren't. These forefathers, so-called forefathers, their ancestors came to this land and demonized and vilified indigenous cosmology and culture, which was in connection with the natural world. And then Thoreau goes out into nature and has like some epiphany.
Builds a cabin.
And goes, oh my God, we are one with nature. We need to protect it.
Right.
But this cabin was built in like indigenous lands and territories where the indigenous peoples had been killed, violently killed, and removed from their lands and territories right. so some white man could have some epiphany and regurgitate the very ideologies that they tried to eradicate.
Right. So, you know, a little bit about me, it's interesting you mentioned the trap line because, you know, I think in my youth and in my adolescence, I was kind of, I self-described Neoletic, right? I was kind of looking at technology as sort of the root of social hierarchy bad. You know, I've come to see this a bit simplistic, but that led me to, you know, not just back to the land, like, you know, woofing on a farm. I actually went up to the Yukon and learned how to trap. And it was really interesting because that was, I think, at a similar time, just around the turn of the millennium, probably a little bit before that, fur prices had crashed because of the activities of environmental activists, you know, the Save the Baby Seals, but also more broadly, right? And it's a strange industry because it's a luxury product.
Yep.
And so it's, you know, activists down in the South, environmentalists are like, there's nothing redemptive about this. But, you know, from what I saw, and I was working with a, like more of a French Canadian trapper than an indigenous one, but, you know, that economy had allowed traditional knowledge to flow. It's imperfect, obviously, but to flow down through generations. And all of a sudden, with that disrupted, it's kind of nothing to do in the winter.
Yeah, I mean, in Stanovim, just nothing to do. Like, these, like, our communities had always traded in furs.
Right.
And like, you know, leathers and other things, like even porcupine quills. Like, these were things that we had always traded in. And so it created a way for us to participate in the first wave of colonialism in a way that allowed us to have our culture intact.
Right.
And so that imposition or this, you know, environmental movement to save the baby seals and to stop the fur trade industry was totally devoid of understanding the unique circumstances of indigenous peoples within those structures.
Right.
And it vilified not only the rich sociolites wanting fur coats, but it vilified those that had been practicing these cultures and traditions for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, and imagine the economic viability.
Hugely,
right? And then there's more dependence relationships. And
you know, I think like, the reality is like, we were told that was the only economy that was viable. Right. That was the only way for us to participate in colonial life.
Right.
I think there were other, our communities have always been economies of trade.
For sure.
So I think like to say that it destroyed our economy, it's a bit challenging because we still had food at the time. We still, like in a really great example is in Fort Chipewyan where my community is from. When the fur trade died, there wasn't like the luxury to be able to like pay for a plane anymore.
Right.
But food was not an issue because at the time we still had our traditional food systems intact.
Right.
So you still had meat in your freezer.
Right.
You still had berries in the bush. You still had medicines.
Right.
The problem is what's happened is it's not just the loss of an economy. The degradation of our ecosystems has been a loss of life for
right.
us.
Right. So I want to get a little more autobiographic with you and understand where you're from.
Yeah.
So Chippewyan,
Fort Chippewyan.
Yeah, so tell me kind of what that was like growing up, what changes you saw, what industries are involved. There's a lot of talk of kind of anti-extractivism, and I want to explore that a little bit more because I think it's a complex topic. But
So, first off, I wasn't born and raised in Fort Chipewyan. My family lived on our traditional trap line in northern Saskatchewan.
Okay.
In an area called N22. It's just like, I don't know.
Coordinates?
It's like near Carswell Lake, Saskatchewan, and south of the shores of Lake Athabasca, near Uranium City.
Right.
So, I mean, you can, just from the name, you know where we're going at. But my family, my parents moved there, and they were both involved with the American Indian Movement. My dad is, that's where he grew up. And they moved to that particular piece of land to reoccupy our family's trap line to oppose the uranium mining that was happening in our territory. And so that's where I was gestated, but actually just before I was born, like my mom was 8 months pregnant. My parents were forcibly removed by armed security of El Dorado Uranium Mining Company because they said that we were squatters on our own traditional trap line. And then we moved to southern Saskatchewan, but because of my dad and his connection to the land and the community, we spent like most of our time actually in the bush, in a wall tent, either in Carswell Lake or up near Fort McMurray, Fort Chipewyan. Like we spent a lot of time in a wall tent with a wood stove. And
was it a hippie killer? Is that what you guys call it?
No.
Like a really thin gauge metal stove that kind of, I had one in my wall tent.
Hippie killer?
We call it hippie killers because it was top loading, right? It was really thin gauge metal. And if you put too much kindling in and kind of passed out, it coughs and the lid, boop, boop, boop. I mean, anyway, this is total aside, but
maybe.
A lot of hippies had their places burned down, right?
But, I don't think so. I don't think we had a hippie killer. But like, I grew up like hauling water from like the rivers and the lakes and like boiling it and like cooking on the fire and my dad teaching us how to like, track animals and set up traps and like all of that kind of stuff. But for the most part, like we home was in southern Saskatchewan in Regina, but always taken to our traditional territory for months at a time.
Way back up north.
Way back up north in our trap line. And a lot of my family still lived in Fort Chipewyan. So my dad was born there. Most of my aunts and uncles were born there. Most of my cousins are there. And that is for us, I was always told that is home. That is home.
Right.
That is where we come from. That is like Kaitale. We are the people of the willow. Right. That's where we're from.
So let's talk a little bit more about the impact of the uranium mines, not just, you know, the mines themselves, but the communities, right? Because I understand, you know, there's a lot of people working within the industry.
Yeah.
They're kind of high paying jobs. But what's the, in terms of like extractivism, like consent is obviously a major issue, but what, like, is there any scenario where that makes sense, or what would be the preconditions of you know, a just engagement with an industry? I'm just trying to think about this because there's this kind of anti-extractivism nature or narrative, which I think is a little bit naive perhaps, because you know, this energy transition has to come from somewhere. There's going to need to be minerals, etc.
Yeah.
So walk me through that. That's way too big of a question.
Yeah,
so take that wherever you want to go.
I think first off, uranium mining. Let's just start there. Sure. I think the reality is that the uranium in northern Saskatchewan and sort of in the Treaty 8 territories of northern Alberta, of northern Saskatchewan, where my people are from, is low-grade uranium. It's shit uranium. Let's be real. And the regulations of the uranium industry in the 70s all the way into the late 90s was piss poor. Right. And they have had indigenous peoples paying them some of the lowest money with no safety training, hauling yellow cake in the back of their pickup trucks. Like, this is, they have no regard for our communities. We think of these types of things happening in third world nations with like poor environmental and human rights standards, but this is happening in northern Saskatchewan. This has been going on for a very long time. And then we talk about the relationships for consent for Indigenous communities and the fact that communities have deals with these companies like Kojima and Areva and all of these big uranium companies. But I can tell you from direct experience, I worked for a small Aboriginal youth magazine called Shout Magazine in the early 2000s. And I was going around and talking to... We had a monthly column on different employment industries. Right. And so we were looking at mining and oil and gas.
Right.
And so I spoke with an executive or someone from, I believe it was Kojima, and we were talking to them about like their employment with Indigenous communities. And no word of a lie, this is what I was told. He's like, we absolutely love working with Indigenous communities. And he pulls out this photo album of all these photos he's taken in all these communities. And he said, you know, we get in there really early. We start making presentations to grade 2 and 3 because we know that they're going to be the leaders signing the deals for our projects in 10 to 15 years. That is called coercion. That is called manipulation. That completely violates the terms of free, prior, and informed consent that are outlined within the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So this is not something that is happening. Like, they were very smart in their tactics and strategies. So they have the buy-in of children so that they know when they become chief in council that they're going to believe that this is the industry that's going to save them, that's going to bring them the economy. And there is something fundamentally so wrong with that scenario, because they're being, it's basically another form of assimilation and indoctrination into colonialism and capitalism that does not equalize or respect our relationship with the natural world and convinces us that it's something separate, it's something that can be divided and bought and sold. And honestly, like, that's super fucked up. So when we talk about consent and relationships and communities making deals, we have to think about how those structures have been set up for us to be bought and sold along with those contracts, or we call them impact benefit agreements in Canada. And it's a really, really broken system, because the reality is Canada, through the treaty process, like, they made an arrangement that they would protect and uphold the rights of our communities, and that we would not be molested by like entities. And they had a fiduciary obligation to ensure that we could continue to access our lands and territories in perpetuity, so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, they have completely devolved their fiduciary responsibilities to ensure that we are not manipulated and coerced by corporate interests and corporate greed. And it's complicated. It's a really, really complicated situation, because when you have destroyed the environment, when you've destroyed traditional economies like the fur trade industry, when you have isolated communities in these small rural northern communities where there's limited access to healthcare, limited access to education beyond, sometimes even beyond grade 9, of course communities want to find ways to create infrastructure so that they can have the same things as everyone else. But the problem is what are we valuing as getting our communities to that point?
Right.
Because if we gave communities the right resources, and we value traditional economies and structures in the same way that we value uranium, I think we would see a fundamental shift in whether or not communities actually signed on to agreements with these companies.
I mean, I understand there's a bit of a like a company town vibe from, again, total outsider having watched a documentary or two, where, you know, the people, there's a number of people working, obviously, and they receive the benefits of that employment. If you're not, you know, working or you're opposed to, I guess it's Cameco now, then you're, like, the communities are very divided, I think, right? Do you have a sense of that, or, like, any story or any...
I mean, you repeat stories? Your story, it's the same thing. Right. I mean, I think what's changed in the last, like, 10, 15 years is that it was about, like, who got the jobs and who didn't get the jobs. And if you got the jobs, you were like, ooh, I have the nice truck and, you know, curtains on my windows. I mean, like, let's be real. Like, that's
those
a thing.
Nice those north,
are, those
right?
are a luxury. It's not necessarily that same thing, because now these companies are looking at signing agreements with the chief and council. And so that is like buying the entire community as opposed to buying a few handful of folks to be like the poster child for like Cameco or Kojima, or like even let's talk about tar sands and Groots on Core. It's the same story over and over again. But these industries are looking at ways, because if they can get one community to sign an impact benefit agreement as a whole from the chief and council, which then chief and council says, we negotiate that X amount of money is given directly to our community upon signing this agreement. I worked for my chief and council, so I've seen these agreements firsthand. And then they get a sort of buyout for signing an agreement. They then get a promise of X amount of jobs every single year for their communities. Sometimes that includes like transportation, particularly if you're an isolated community, fly in, fly out programs, all the things, training for management. It sounds really, really wonderful. But for a lot of the times, it doesn't work out the way that you want to, other than the actual transaction of finances. It's not the deals that most of our communities sign up for. And that's where we're starting to see some of those relationships with corporations are breaking down. Like my nation, Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, sued Shell Oil for failure to meet their obligations under an impact benefit agreement. And we're starting to see this over and over again. So it's those empty promises, like treaty, where they said they would do all these wonderful things and make sure that we had all the things we needed, and then, you know, rescinding on those agreements and being like, well, you know, get over it.
I mean, it's interesting being at this conference. You know, climate change is a big question of energy transition, right? Transitioning off of, you know, liquids and gases, petroleum, gas, coal, and that involves really a transition often to minerals in terms of lithium batteries or the rare earth metals, or even just the iron ore that's needed in wind turbines and things like that, and potentially uranium for nuclear reactors. In a sense, it has to come from somewhere if that's the future, if it is an energy transition, and that's complicated. And I see, you know, out on the street, there's posters, you know, anti-extractivism. But at the same time, like, the only thing that's not mining related is, you know, maybe plant-based fabrics and leather, and you know what I mean? Like, so how do you navigate that tension?
Well, I think that this gets into the structures of that colonialism has created in our society, that we have all drank the Kool-Aid. Like, we are products of systems of deep capitalism and predatory capitalism that we are all complicit and have bought into. But that's because we've been coerced and manipulated into believing that's the only structure. And that comes from that devaluing and invisibilizing and demonizing of other systems outside of that colonial capitalist model. And so, yes, we have to transition to something. And yes, there are cleaner energy systems, but at what cost? And so it's really about a fundamental paradigm shift. Like, how do we not just talk about transitioning energy systems, how do we talk about reducing our reliance on energy systems, like that we, you know, have all the lights on all the time? Big cities, the big buildings have lights on all night long. It's not just light pollution. This is like energy leaching that we absolutely don't need. And we really have to be thinking about how we have to fundamentally change our relationships with each other and the lands and where we come from. That means looking at not just those energy systems that we're saying we need to phase out of. But like, I'm going to stop there for a minute.
Yeah.
I had an elder during the tar sands campaign that I was a part of say, I'm having a real challenge because we say dirty oil and gas, but that oil and gas comes from the earth. And we talk about the spirit of the water. We talk about the spirit of the mountains and the sun and the moon and the sky. But that oil and that coal has a spirit too. And we are trying to demonize the spirit. And we'd say we don't want it, but it is a part of the natural world. We have perverted our relationship with these spirits. The spirits of these fossil fuels, and that we have to not talk about like get rid of it forever, because it needs to be in the earth, it needs to stay in the ground, not because it's like some demon, but because that's where it belongs. And that is a different way of talking about like keep fossil fuels in the ground. We're not talking about GHGs in the atmosphere. We're talking about the relationships that every single thing has and the roles and responsibilities that it has within those structures. And so when we talk about energy transitions and we talk about cobalt and lithium and all the things that are necessary, uranium, that people are saying these are the systems that we need, we still have to reconcile our relationships. What is the spirit of these things? How are we relating to them? Are we just moving from one extractive industry to create and pervert another system?
Right.
And if we don't understand the purpose and the spirit of those things, and we just move from one resource to another resource, utilizing the same mentality and fundamental value system that has gotten us into the crisis, we will continue to violate the rights of communities, of indigenous peoples. We will continue to destroy the land and the ecosystems that we so desperately need in order to combat the climate crisis. And so it's not about saying no to everything. It's about saying no to the commodification and the capitalist systems that have sort of predicated these structures, about even the ideologies of Catholicism, that man created this earth, or that God created this earth for man.
Right.
And like, it's not man's dominion over nature. Like, we are a part of these systems. And so I'm just like, I understand why people say uranium and nuclear is the way to go, but actually no, you know, because there are still human consequences. And same with solar, same with lithium, all of these things. So how do we start to build those relationships? Because our communities, for example, use tar sands to like help line our boats and do all sorts of other things. You know, gold mining was something that happened in Africa before we had like massive gold mining in parts of Africa. And now those gold mines are killing communities. But those communities, you know, they mine this stuff on small scale for thousands of years. And it's about that relationality of how we build solutions that are regional and local. And it means that we have to reimagine what a globalized economy looks like that isn't built on structures of predatory economies and predatory capitalism, but one that rights our relationships with the places where we come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This podcast is very focused on issues of energy and energy transition. And the basis of it is this idea of decoupling. And that's a lot to do with assessing various technologies and which ones are which suit goals, right? So, you know, whether it's decarbonization or lack of air pollution or using the least amount of mining or resources. And so we're trying to assess those things. You know, nuclear energy has certainly come up as one of the things where there is a relatively smaller footprint in some ways. Where you don't have air pollution, et cetera. So something we've covered a lot. But again, I was very interested in talking to someone whose territory is...
The life cycle.
Yeah.
This is the issue that we have to deal with. The life cycle of the impacts of mining uranium and creating nuclear sites is infinite in regards, in comparison to other systems of energy. Like my territory from the uranium extraction that's happened there, like the reclamation, we don't know that it'll ever be reclaimed to a level that is anywhere to where we had before. Like, will our rivers ever be safe to drink there? Mm-hmm. I have some cousins that are trying to go back and reoccupy that land. And, you know, it's Cameco, probably. Cameco's like, yeah, you can come here anytime you want. But the river is not safe to drink from, you know, like, it's just like, we're still in reclamation, but you're more than welcome to come. And it's like, what is reclamation? Like, reclamation is generations. Reclamation is generations of loss. And even then it will never return to the same levels because of the radiation that's associated with uranium mining. And so these are sacrifice zones for people to continue to fly to Glasgow to participate in international climate negotiations. And, you know, we're sitting here with our cell phones and all of the technology we use. And I think, like, again, I understand why people see that, but the sacrifices that it results in, like, and I think to my brothers and sisters south of the Medicine Line in the so-called United States, in Navajo Nation, that are actually directly relatives, like, we're Athabascan people, and they come from the same lineage as us. So much so that their language is very similar. And they're dealing with uranium extraction and, you know, our nuclear waste storage facilities. We talk about a lower GHG footprint, but the impacts are multi-generational. And not just on the land, but literally to the health of our bodies and the longevity of our people to be able to be in relationship with those places that made us who we are.
In terms of, you know, just the sheer number of people in the world, and I think within the environmental movement, there's a real idea that we need to sort of return to simpler ways and simpler times. The way that the planet is changing and the kind of, I mean, the mitigation that's so important, but the adaptation that's important as well, and just the sheer size, like, it's interesting looking at the scale of what's required for these visions of transition. And, you know, it's kind of swapping out, right? Like, there's definitely huge impacts from oil extraction, and then there's, you know, as in the Andes not too long ago, and talking to indigenous people there about lithium extraction. One thing that was interesting yesterday, there's a lot of African countries represented in the pavilions. There's only like 3 South American ones and maybe 12 or 13 African ones. But a colleague of mine was walking around and talking with people from a forestry ministry. I think it was in Congo. And they were saying, we need energy so that we don't use the forest, because so much of it is being turned into charcoal. And so we asked them, you know, well, what form of energy? And they said, we don't care, we just need energy. Talk to the energy ministry. You know, is it better if it's carbon free? Yes. But it was a very interesting moment, because you don't usually think about it in that regard. I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Like, I mean, I guess that the reality is that let's compare the Congo to Canada. Let's go there. The reality is that the Congo has been in political turmoil for a really long time, but as far as their access to technology, you know, stable housing, medicine, education, they're like leagues behind us. And there's been this ideology that is sold globally now, that you want to be like one of the G7 states. That's what every country wants to, that they're striving to work towards. And it creates like a really imbalance, because those systems that the Congo and other developing nations are striving to become like are the very reason we're in the climate crisis. But at the same time, like, they should have right to accessible, clean, potable water, energy systems, education, healthcare, but we have literally in North America and the EU, where we have the modernization, these G7 countries, we're the reason that they might never be able to have that. Like, we're the reason that we have destabilized water tables, ecosystems, biodiversity, energy structures, the fact that, like, they have tar sands in the Congo. They have shale oil in the Congo. Like, it's like, we're, and people have tried to extract it. Like, we're at the bottom dredges of trying to keep our status quo as business as usual and then telling folks in the Congo, sorry, you can't have that. And it's just a really fucked up system that we're like, no, like, we already don't have enough energy in the planet while we keep our lights on in like big sky rises in these modern cities. Like, the fundamental problem isn't the Congo wanting to have energy systems. The fundamental problem is the way in which we have subscribed to an energy model and way of living that is so unsustainable that as we fight for a solution to the climate crisis, we say we don't want to compromise that.
Right.
Even Obama said, like, we are looking for solutions that will ensure that every American gets to continue to live the lives that they have ever, I don't know, summarizing some of the things he said. Some of the most progressive leaders, like even Trudeau, they're not looking
progressive leaders.
But, you know, in the World Forum, like even in these spaces, people
brand
are like...
progressive.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like so-called progressive leaders of the world, they're not actually telling their citizens that shit needs to change.
Right.
They're just like, we're going to find a solution that allows us to continue to have way more than others.
Right.
And that comes from those systemic systems of, honestly, colonialism and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Because the developing nations tend to be black and brown nations.
Sure, yeah.
And they're not allowed to have the same.
There was a very interesting moment that happened yesterday at the German Pavilion. A South African friend of ours was there, and it was serendipitous. They were just making an announcement that Germany is forcing a divestment from foreign development of fossil fuels. And this is at a time when Germany's grid is 27% powered by coal. And so the South African friend was like, wait, you get to burn coal, but we don't?
Exactly. You know? This is exactly it. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
I had a question. I have a friend who lives in Nunavut, and they import, I think it was a few years ago when oil prices were a bit higher, but it was $250 billion, a quarter billion dollars spent on fossil fuel. And it seems like, I was talking to another guy, an indigenous guy from the Cowessess Nation who does a lot of work up north as well, and he was talking about how these, because of the way that, indigenous people were forced onto reserves and forced to settle, and he described this community where there was like 5 or 6 kilometers of almost a desert because people were having to go further and further to cut wood.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that the Canadian North is really vulnerable because, for instance, Iqaluit, how can they heat without fossil fuels right now? It's 4,000 or 5,000 people. It's a really, really tricky area. I mean, do you have any thoughts about the North and it seems so
There's
hard
so
to solve.
So many thoughts on
okay,
the North.
Okay, cool. We'll leave it. We'll get you to do those.
So the reality is that subpar materials and standards for housing have led basically, this is modern living. This is how you live. It's been forced upon, again, forced tactics of assimilation into these communities. And this is how you live. And then giving them subpar materials that don't withstand the conditions, mold, all sorts of problems that we see in those housing, and leaching energy like you wouldn't believe. We leach energy from our homes in the cities here. Imagine going into places where you're talking about minus 60 temperatures.
Yeah.
That's not efficient. Mm-hmm. So of course they're importing $250 million in energy because the infrastructure that they've been told is what they should be doing in order to be modern people and live in society is fucking shit. We need real engineers to be working with those communities. We need to see commitments from the so-called colonial leaders to actually not just say, oh yeah, you need better housing, but you don't have the funding for it.
Mm-hmm.
The folks in the Arctic are the first and the worst to be impacted by climate change, and they're being told that they need to figure out their energy systems and their dependency on fossil fuels and come up with something else. But only if it's still within that colonial system, that's when it's valued. If someone in those communities said, we're going to go back to building traditional infrastructures and homes, those people would probably get their children taken away by CFS, Children and Family Services.
Right.
There's no valuation for Indigenous cultures and modalities of living. They're not funded. They're not valued. And they do provide real ways in which we can look at how do we build it. Imagine if they took some of the traditional housing systems of the Inuit people and they built traditional housing with real resources and real financing to get them to a place that isn't leaching energy in the way that their current housing infrastructure is. I think we would see a decrease in energy leaching and the dependency on fossil fuels. I think we would see pride and culture be revitalized, which would lead to the community being more, again, in relationship with the natural world, leading to increased biodiversity, better qualities of life, localized economies, and it would be much better because they wouldn't have to import. Because a lot of the things, I was talking with one of our delegates is Inuit, and another one is from another community on the coastal nation in northern BC. Their traditional foods are like devalued. Ew, you eat that? And so you're seeing people move further and further away from traditional foods and be dependent on these grocery stores. Yeah. Now imagine if they were not like, ew, that's so gross, I can't believe you eat like whale blubber or like seal soup or whatever it is that were the traditional foods. Because they're like, fish? Oh yeah, you eat fish, you want to eat crabs, you want to eat all the food that the colonialists have said, yes, that's delicious. Yeah. And you're seeing this sort of assimilation tactic. But if we celebrated indigenous cultures, indigenous economies, indigenous food systems, I truly believe that we would see that decrease in dependency, the importation of those foods, importation of fuel and energy systems, and we would be able to effectively implement regionally based indigenous informed solutions that could fundamentally shift the way in which we think about solutions to the climate crisis, both mitigation and adaptation.
Okay, Ariel, I've kept you 2 minutes too long. I know you have other things to do today. Thank you so much for making the time to come on Decouple.
Thank you.
Really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Yeah. Thanks.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, like, and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, guys.